1830 became a cause célèbre for the people of Fallujah, who would raise them repeatedly in negotiations with U.S. forces over the next year. Francis Bing West, the embedded defense analyst and author who has spent more time studying U.S. military operations in Anbar province than any other unofficial observer, concluded that the Sunnis, and especially the people of Fallujah and the rest of Anbar province, had never been defeated in the spring invasion. In that sense, the April incidents may have been not so much a cause of later troubles as a reflection of an existing problem. The Sunnis still wanted to slug it out. At any rate, Fallujah would continue to be the victim of U.S. military absent-mindedness, with its problems underestimated and a variety of different army units deployed to it in stopgap moves. Over the course of a few months, the city was patrolled by parts of the 82nd Airborne, then by Poirier's MP-led task force, then by the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, then by parts of the 3rd Infantry Division, and then by the 82nd Airborne when it returned later in 2003. Finally, it would be turned over to the Marines, with a battle following soon after. Fallujah had 5 different units handling it between April 03 and April 04, said one Army intelligence officer who served in Anbar province. This is exactly the wrong way to prosecute a counterinsurgency fight. At the northern end of the Sunni triangle, another army division made a similarly belligerent entrance. In mid-April, the Marines briefly occupied Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit and were preparing to turn it over to the Army's 4th Infantry Division. Unusual for an officially produced document, the official history produced by the 1st Division of the Marine Corps is disapproving, even contemptuous, of what it calls the 4th Infantry Division's very aggressive posture as that unit came into Iraq. The lead elements of this division began to arrive in Tikrit on the 19th of April and were given a thorough orientation to the peaceful situation in town and the continuing exercise in self-governance being worked with local leaders, stated the draft of the 1st Marine Division history of its time in Iraq in 2003. Despite that, it continued, the arriving staff of the 4th Infantry Division had a sterner perspective on the situation. They characterized their recent road march to Tikrit from Kuwait as an attack and remained convinced that the situation in Tikrit required a very aggressive military enforcement posture. The dichotomy between the two peacekeeping strategies was unsettling for the Marines, and many winced when Army Apache attack helicopters swooped into the division battle space without coordination and began to strafe abandoned enemy equipment indiscriminately, often in close proximity to Marine forces or innocent civilians. Strikingly, the draft of the Marine history became even more pointed when it was revised. The final version noted that the Marines threw a farewell dinner to cement relationships with local tribal leaders. The design was to use this opportunity to pass down relationships based on trust and mutual respect, the history stated. The meeting was successfully concluded, with plans for future contact with the northern tribes established. Then, it goes on to say somewhat ominously, the meeting might have been even more productive had senior officers from 4th Infantry Division been willing to attend. The history dryly notes that the Marines, despite some misgivings, turned over the area to the 4th Infantry Division and departed on April 21. Stores that had reopened quickly closed back up as the people once again evacuated the streets, adjusting to the new security tactics, the final draft of the history reported. A budding cooperative environment between the citizens and American forces was quickly snuffed out. The new adversarial relationship would become a major source of trouble in the coming months. The Army perspective was quite different. Lieutenant Colonel John Gentile, who was executive officer of the Army Brigade relieving the Marines in Tikrit, later argued, "The Marines' velvet glove covered some dangerous problems that we were soon to face." When the Army sent out a night patrol, which he said the Marines hadn't done, it encountered looters carrying off rocket-propelled grenades and mortar rounds. Major General Raymond Odierno, the 4th ID commander, later said that he was very confused by the Marines' criticism. "It was such a short period of time that the two services overlapped in Tikrit," he said. At any rate, he knew of only one instance of an Army Apache helicopter firing without needed clearance from the Marines. But it wasn't just Marines who were taken aback by the 4th ID's aggressive stance. Unlike most Army divisions, it hadn't been deployed for decades, missing out on Panama, the 1991 Gulf War, Somalia, Bosnia, Kosovo, and Afghanistan. At its home base of Fort Hood, Texas, it sometimes was mocked as the second team, taking a back seat to its neighbor, the 1st Cavalry Division. Then it was assigned the role of invading Iraq from the north in the spring 2003 attack, only to be prevented from executing that mission when the Turkish government declined to permit the movement of U.S. troops through its territory. It is remarkable how consistently other soldiers were put off by the 4th Division's stance during its early days in Iraq. "We slowly drove past 4th Infantry guys looking mean and ugly," recalled Sergeant Kayla Williams, then a military intelligence specialist in the 101st Airborne. "They stood on top of their trucks, their weapons pointed directly at civilians. What could these locals possibly have done? Why was this intimidation necessary? No one explained anything, but it looked weird and felt wrong." Her gut sense would be borne out in the coming months, as the 4th ID would commit more than its share of abuses of Iraqis. On April 19, as Pentagon officials continued to insist that there were enough troops to do the job and that commanders on the ground agreed with them, Major General Mattis, one of the senior U.S. military commanders in Iraq, noted in an internal message that the incoming Army occupation force lacked sufficient numbers of troops. "The lack of Army dismounts, regular infantry, is creating a void in personal contact and public perception of our civil military ops," Mattis wrote. At month's end, despite the concerns about the lack of troops, the Marines were told to execute previously existing plans to pull out and head home. "Most of us were flabbergasted to be told to leave Baghdad at the end of April," recalled Marine Colonel John Tulin. "I turned over my sector, which was East Baghdad, to 2nd ACR, Armored Cavalry Regiment, which had about one-fifth the capability of my regiment." Even before he left Iraq, Tulin recalled Mattis, his commander, took him aside and said he thought that the situation was deteriorating and that the Marines would be pulled back into Iraq eventually. "Don't lose sight of what you've learned," he recalled Mattis telling him, "because you're going to need to get your guys ready to come back." Off the top of his head, Mattis picked November 10, an easily remembered date because it's the Marine Corps' birthday, as the target date by which he wanted his troops to be ready to head back to Iraq. In fact, the deployment order would arrive on November 7. Publicly, at least, all was going well. One of the roles of a president is to provide strategic context, to explain how the public, and especially how subordinate officials, should think about a situation. On May 1, 2003, President Bush ostentatiously flew in a Navy combat aircraft to the USS Abraham Lincoln, an aircraft carrier steaming off the coast of Southern California. The day is remembered, somewhat unfairly, as the occasion of Bush's "mission accomplished" speech. Bush never used that phrase, which was hanging prominently on a huge banner displayed on the ship's island, the tower where the captain and the flight controllers operate, so that television cameras focused on the president would pick it up. But his comments were in line with that theme. "Major combat operations in Iraq have ended," he began, standing on the ship's flight deck. "In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed." He did nod toward the operations that remained, which he seemed to characterize as a mop-up job. "We have difficult work to do in Iraq. We're bringing order to parts of that country that remain dangerous. We're pursuing and finding leaders of the old regime who will be held to account for their crimes. We've begun the search for hidden chemical and biological weapons, and already know of hundreds of sites that will be investigated. Doing all this, and establishing democracy, will take time, but it is worth every effort." And, as he often would do in discussing Iraq in public, he circled back to the 9/11 attacks, clearly his starting point on the road to Baghdad. "The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001, he said. Chapter 8, How to Create an Insurgency, Part 1, Spring and Summer, 2003. The feeling of post-war impatience was the same at the Pentagon, recalled an officer who was on the joint staff at the time. "There was a mindset by the first part of May Major combat operations are over. Let's think about drawing down the force. From late spring to mid-summer 2003 was a time of meandering and drift for the U.S. occupation of Iraq. It took months for incorrect assumptions to begin to be discarded and for commanders to recognize that large numbers of U.S. troops were going to be in Iraq for some time. In the 2 or 3 months of ambiguous transition, U.S. forces slowly lost the momentum and the initiative they had gained over an off-balance enemy, Major Isaiah Wilson later wrote. During this calm before the next storm, the U.S. Army has its eyes turned toward the ports, while former regime loyalists, FRL, and budding insurgents had their eyes turned toward the people. The United States, its army, and its coalition of the willing have been playing catch-up ever since. As the situation turned violent, some U.S. soldiers began to question why they were in Iraq. Motivation was not a problem during the initial stages. However, once we transitioned into SASO, Stability and Support Operations, the U.S. military term for peacekeeping, it became a problem. One Army lieutenant observed that summer on an internet discussion board for young officers. It didn't take much time before I realized that they were lacking any sense of purpose. They didn't know why they weren't going home, why they couldn't see their first child born, and why we were helping an ungrateful and hostile populace. Added an intelligence officer who was attached to a Navy SEAL unit at the time, the air went out of the tires almost overnight. Baghdad was falling apart in front of the eyes of the U.S. military, with buildings being looted and parents afraid to let their children outside. But no one had orders to do anything about it. Looking back several years later, Colonel Alan King, the head of civil affairs for the 3rd Infantry Division, spoke of April 2003 with a slow, chilled tone of horror in his voice. "I got to Baghdad and was told, 'You got 24 hours to come up with a Phase 4 plan.' On the night of April 8, Colonel John Sterling, the chief of staff of the 3rd ID, came to me and said, 'I just got off the phone with the Corps chief of staff, and I asked him for the reconstruction plan, and he said there isn't one. So you got 24 hours to come up with one.'" King was stunned. He had been asking for months for just such a plan, and had been told that when the time came, he would be given it. Lacking clear orders about what to do once in Baghdad, the 3rd ID more or less stayed in place in the capital. "You didn't find many dismounted patrols with the 3rd ID," recalled Jay Garner, a retired Army general and not one to lightly criticize his old peers. "They kind of stayed with their platforms, that is, their tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles." On April 6, Lieutenant Douglas Hoyt, a platoon leader with the 3rd ID, saw looters for the first time. "I remembered looking through the sights on my tank at people and trying to determine if they were hostile or not," he recalled later. "He didn't stop them. It was not our mission at the time." It wasn't just a lack of planning or guidance from civilians that led to the U.S. inertia. It also was a lack of understanding or interest among senior military commanders. The civilian leadership did not foresee the need for extensive Phase 4 operations, and thus did little planning beyond near-term relief, said one Pentagon official who was involved in wargaming the invasion plan, and who later quietly analyzed its failures. This was fine with the military, which had traditionally focused on Phase 3 operations, did not want to do Phase 4 operations, and figured that someone else would step in. Brigadier General David Fastabend told the story of reading an article in which a fellow Army general was quoted as saying that Army doctrine hadn't prepared him for what he faced in Iraq during the late spring of 2003. When he met this officer, Fastabend, who was involved in developing doctrine, that is, how to think about how to fight and operate, questioned him about that statement. "I don't understand why you said that," Fastabend said. "Look, in 1993 we introduced military operations other than war, and then we introduced the idea of full-spectrum operations. From 97 to 2001 we introduced the idea that operations are a seamless combination of offense, defense, stability, and support. How could you say that your doctrine didn't prepare you for what you experienced in Baghdad?" "Yeah, Dave, I know," this officer responded. "I read all that stuff. I read it many times and thought about it. But I can remember quite clearly, I was on a street corner in Baghdad smoking a cigar, watching some guys carry a sofa by, and it never occurred to me that I was going to be the guy to go get that sofa back. One of the notable exceptions to this sense of drift was in areas where Army Special Forces operated, in far northern and western Iraq. Those soldiers were much more accustomed to living and working with foreign populations. The experience of Army Major Jim Gavrilis showed the road that unfortunately was not taken by the overwhelming majority of the U.S. military in Iraq. At 6 o'clock on the morning of April 9, the career Special Forces officer drove into Arutba, the only town of any size in far western Iraq. His troops had come under intense fire from this town of about 25,000 people, but he didn't enter it in a hostile fashion. I understood that this was a war of liberation, and therefore the people were ultimately the center of gravity, he later wrote, in a simple sentence of great insight. As a result, it was natural for us to focus on the people and build positive relationships with them. He drank tea with Bedouins in the desert, smoked cigarettes with farmers near the towns, and broke bread with police chiefs, and even with Iraqi army officers. He listened. He ate with his fingers, as they did. He emphasized that it was their country, and that he was a guest who hoped to help. Our behavior sent the clearest message, he later wrote. We showed we cared more about the people of Arutba than did the Saddam Fedayeen. This was a classic counterinsurgency move, implemented at the most opportune time, before there was an insurgency. Gavrilis co-opted the existing power structure. When some sheiks came to complain about looting, he knew some of them were behind those acts, he said. So he put those very sheiks in charge of a neighborhood watch program and held them accountable for any continued looting, with U.S. troops monitoring the situation in random patrols. The stealing dropped to almost nothing. He also gave relief food supplies to the sheiks and imams because he realized that they knew who really needed it. To help the rest of the population obtain food, he lent his satellite phone to local merchants so they could contact business partners in Jordan. In a day, the market had fresh fruit and vegetables, and fresh fish and meat for the first time in months. One hallmark of his approach was a humility about his role and his limited ability to alter a culture whose roots reached back to the days of Abraham and Ezekiel. The laws and values of their society and culture were just fine, he wrote. All we needed to do was enforce them. Emphasizing this attitude of restraint, he lived simply, not moving into any palaces as conventional U.S. forces were doing elsewhere in Iraq. He also took a gentle approach to debathification. First, he offered to turn the Ba'ath Party headquarters, the nicest building in the city, into a hospital. He also developed a renunciation form in which people who were becoming part of the interim government repudiated the party and pledged to serve and protect the people of the new Iraq. Signing the form wasn't done punitively. It was more of a commencement where we congratulated each person for their courage in turning this new leaf, he wrote. Those who wanted to sign the form in private were allowed to do so. Simply put, debathification meant political change, not political purge. The one area in which Gavrilis took a hard line was on violence. No one but U.S. forces were permitted to carry a weapon. I made it very clear that I retained the monopoly on the use of force. In sum, he treated Iraqis as partners. Rather than seek to break the structure of an ancient society, he sought to use it to achieve his ends. But he was careful in establishing those goals and realistic in seeking to achieve them, acting with both humility and common sense. He took almost the opposite course that the U.S. occupation authorities based in Baghdad would dictate in the following months. He left Arutba on April 23. By midsummer, the atmosphere in those towns in the province, from Rutba east to Fallujah, would be far more hostile. In Baghdad, meanwhile, Jay Garner was off to an uneven start as the head of the reconstruction effort. His initial moves were making Ahmed Chalabi uneasy, and the Iraqi exile had better contacts in the U.S. government and in the media than the retired general did. Garner found that he had a particularly difficult relationship with Chalabi as well. Very tense, he said. He didn't like me. The reason for the mutual unease, Garner believed, was that Chalabi thought the control of Iraq would be turned over to him. I think he'd been led to believe that by Pearl and Fife, Garner said later. And Garner didn't like that idea. I thought he was a thug, very sleazy. When he heard a year later that Chalabi allegedly had been passing intelligence to the Iranian government, I thought, no shit. Chalabi, for his part, was doing his best during this period to undercut Garner. The problem with Garner was that he was employing Baathists in senior positions, and the U.S. press got hold of that, Chalabi later said. They went ahead and put in the New York Times that Baathists were being made to run the university, Ministry of Health. That created a big fuss with the United States, because the U.S. policy was de-Baathification. Chalabi acknowledged that he was pushing this view very hard at the time. Also, even as it occupied Baghdad, the U.S. government was still undecided on the basics of what it planned to do there. Most notably, officials went back and forth on the issue of whether to maintain the Iraqi military. The U.S. military generally advocated keeping the Iraqi forces relatively intact. "We'd been briefing, 'Keep the Iraqi army,'" said a military intelligence officer. "It is solid, it has structure and discipline, and credibility inside Iraq." In mid-April, Abizaid strongly recommended to the Pentagon that a substantial Iraqi army be established immediately, according to an internal summary of a secure video teleconference. This interim force would have 3 divisions. The U.S. Army at the time had just 10 for the entire world, and would take over internal security functions as quickly as possible, the document stated. A subsequent memo noted that there was an urgent need to maintain order, suppress various militias, put an Iraqi face on security, and relieve burden on coalition military. Wolfowitz, who participated in the video teleconference, expressed concern about having the Iraqi army perform internal security missions, but he and Abizaid concluded by agreeing to start up a force and worry later about its mission. By month's end, Central Command staffers were hard at work on this new Iraqi corps, which they inevitably acronymized as the NIC, or NIC, not knowing that the sound was Arabic slang for fuck. When several weeks later this was pointed out to U.S. officials, the planned organization was renamed the New Iraqi Army. Garner's team began to work toward the goal of assembling Iraqi army units, talking to former officers and getting their advice about how to go about it. At the same time, there was growing unease back in Washington with Garner's performance. Condoleezza Rice was told that "Garner just isn't pulling things together," recalled Franklin Miller, the National Security Council's staff director for defense issues. On the night of April 24, Garner was standing in the looted mess of Saddam Hussein's main palace downtown, broken glass under his shoes, when Rumsfeld called to tell him that a retired diplomat named L. Paul Bremer III would be coming in as a presidential envoy. "He asked me to stay on under Bremer, but I said that wouldn't work. He asked me to stay on for a transition, and I said I would." One of the unexplained oddities of this time was the absence of much of the nation's top military leadership. Just as the situation in Iraq was deteriorating, there was a series of retirements and replacements among the top commanders handling it. The changes would occur, just as Garner was succeeded by Bremer, with ill effect. At the top of the chain of command for operations in Iraq, General Franks seemed quickly to have detached from Iraq issues. Some of those who worked with him found him remote and even out of touch in the weeks after the fall of Baghdad. Franks was getting ready to retire, while Abizaid was not yet confirmed by Congress to succeed him as the top U.S. military commander for Iraq and the rest of the Mideast. A Pentagon official said that top officials got wind at one point that Franks planned to fly from the Mideast to Tampa, pick up his wife, and take a long weekend, maybe in the Bahamas. Franks ultimately was ordered not to. "He put his pack down early," said a former senior administration official. "He couldn't even be found a lot of the times." General Shinseki, the chief of the U.S. Army, left the stage at about the same time. Neither Defense Secretary Rumsfeld nor Deputy Defense Secretary Wolfowitz attended the scorned general's retirement ceremony. Wolfowitz asked to come, but Shinseki declined to invite him. It was an extraordinary situation. While the nation was at war and American soldiers were dying, the Pentagon's top civilians were estranged from the Army's leadership. What's more, it was the second bitter departure of an Army four-star general under Rumsfeld. General Henry Hugh Shelton, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had retired in 2001, just weeks after 9/11, disgusted with Rumsfeld and feeling he had recklessly disregarded sound military advice. After General Keane declined the job of succeeding Shinseki, Rumsfeld, in an unusual move, passed over all the Army's active duty 3- and 4-star generals, normally the ones who would be considered, to appoint as chief a retired general named Peter Shoemaker. When Rumsfeld's aides first contacted Shoemaker, they reached him on his cell phone in his pickup truck near rural Hyco, Texas, a bit north of Fort Hood. The retired general thought he might be getting a prank call from the rancher he'd just left. Furthering the Army's isolation, Shoemaker was an outsider. He had spent most of his career in special operations, which often acts and is treated as if it were a separate service from the Army. On the ground in Iraq, the structure of U.S. forces also was in flux. After being told for 2 weeks that both the 1st Cavalry Division and 1st Armored Division would be deploying, Colonel Agoglio was told on April 30 that the 1st Cav wouldn't be coming after all, and that the 3rd ID would be leaving after the 1st AD arrived. "So we have a net gain of zero," he calculated to himself. "You're kidding me." In addition, instead of having Iraq run by General McKiernan and his staff at Siflic, the headquarters for the ground invasion force, the staff of 5 Corps, a smaller group, was going to be put in charge. This meant that an experienced team that had worked for months on Iraq issues was being replaced by a smaller, less capable, and less seasoned staff. McKiernan's headquarters was especially attuned to the tribal structure of Iraqi society, an intelligence officer recalled. "They were sent home, and that expertise and capability went with them. We spent from May 03 to December 03 trying to rebuild that capability." What's more, a general named Ricardo Sanchez was going to take over 5 Corps at the same time. So now you have the most junior headquarters in the theater, with the most junior commander in the theater, taking over, Agoglio recalled. You've got the entire military chain of command changing. Agoglio also moved, rewarded for his 2 years of nonstop work in the frying pan of planning wars for General Franks, by being thrown into the fire as the military liaison between the CPA and Central Command. Bremer headed for Iraq in early May, determined to show that there was a new sheriff in town. In a memo to the Pentagon's General Counsel written just before his departure, he noted his desire that my arrival in Iraq be marked by clear, public, and decisive steps to reassure Iraqis that we are determined to eradicate Saddamism. One of those steps, he decided, would be the total dissolution of the Iraqi army. He attached the draft of an order to that end, that, he said, Walt Slocum has suggested that I issue immediately after my arrival. Slocum was a former Pentagon official who had agreed to be Bremer's advisor on defense issues. On May 12, 2003, Bremer arrived in Baghdad aboard a Special Operations MC-130 combat Talon aircraft. He and Garner overlapped for just a few weeks. Garner had told Rumsfeld he would stay as late as early July, but soon found that his views weren't particularly welcome. "Jerry Bremer didn't want my advice. He's a hard-working guy, 20 hours a day, but he cut me out the first day, didn't have me to any of his meetings, so on the 3rd day he was there, I said, 'Jerry, I'm going home.' We just didn't get along." For his own part, Bremer, a veteran diplomat who had gone on to work as a consultant, was taken aback by the situation on the ground. "I found a city that was on fire, not from the war, but from the looting," he later said. "I found a city where there was virtually no traffic except for American military vehicles or coalition tanks and Humvees, a city where there was a lot of gunfire still going on." In mid-May, Bremer quickly made 3 moves that radically altered the American approach to Iraq and went a long way toward creating support for an anti-American insurgency. Oddly, these early moves contradicted the decisions made by President Bush on March 10 and 12 at briefings on post-war Iraq, according to an administration official who participated in both. They were not the decisions that the administration had reached, Richard Armitage confirmed in an interview. One of the first things Bremer did after arriving in Iraq was show Garner the order he intended to issue to rid Iraq of Ba'athist leadership. Senior party members, it stated, are hereby removed from their positions and banned from future employment in the public sector. In addition, anyone holding a position in the top three management layers of any ministry, government-run corporation, university, or hospital, and who was a party member, even of a junior rank, would be deemed to be a senior Ba'athist and so would be fired. What's more, those suspected of crimes would be investigated and, if deemed a flight risk, would be detained or placed under house arrest. Garner was appalled. This went far beyond what he had planned for months, and in fact had briefed for Rumsfeld and President Bush. The message Garner had given his subordinates, recalled his strategy chief, Colonel Paul Hughes, was let them sort out their own debathification, either kill them or force them to leave. If issued as written, the order Bremer was carrying would lead to disaster, Garner thought. He went to see the CIA station chief, whom Garner had seen work well with the military. "This is too hard," Garner told the CIA officer, who read it and agreed. The two allies went back to Bremer. "Give us an hour or so to redo this," Garner asked. "Absolutely not," Bremer responded. "I have my instructions, and I am going to issue this." The CIA station chief urged Bremer to reconsider. "These are the people who know where the levers of the infrastructure are, from electricity to water to transportation," he said. "Take them out of the equation and you undercut the operation of this country," he warned. "No," said Bremer. "Okay," the veteran CIA man responded. "Do this," he said, "but understand one thing. By nightfall, you'll have driven 30,000 to 50,000 Ba'athists underground, and in 6 months, you'll really regret this." The U.S. intelligence estimate was that the party had a total membership of 600 to 700,000, of which between 15 and 40,000 were senior members, depending on how one counted. Bremer looked at the two. "I have my instructions," he repeated, according to Garner, though it isn't clear that he really did, as the policy he was implementing wasn't what had been briefed to the president. A few months later, the veteran CIA man would leave Baghdad, replaced by a far more junior officer. In the fall of 2005, he would resign from government service. The next day, Bremer met in his conference room, the only big room in the palace with working air conditioners, with his senior CPA staff members. He showed them the debathification order. They went nuts and said, "You can't do this," recalled Gardner, the army colonel assigned to CPA. "It just cleaned out the ministries. The guy said, we can't run our ministries now." Bremer again refused to budge. His response, said Gardner, was that he wasn't bringing up the issue for discussion, but rather just to inform them of what was going to happen. It appears that with this move, Chalabi, operating behind the scenes, had won a major victory. Army Lieutenant General Joseph Kellogg, Jr., then on the staff of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, recalled that Chalabi had been a strong backer of the radical debathification plan Bremer brought with him. He was calling for total debathification, which was extreme. "I think the world of Jerry Bremer," said Kellogg, who sat across from Bremer on the Special Operations C-130 aircraft that took them into Iraq. "He is personally courageous and a good guy. But his management style didn't work well. If you went up to him and said, you gotta do this because your way is wrong, he'd blow you off. So you'd have to work the sides. We'd kind of work around him." On May 16, debathification of Iraq society was issued over Bremer's signature as Coalition Provisional Authority Order No. 1. It purged tens of thousands of members of the Ba'ath Party, perhaps as many as 85,000. Ultimately, 9,000 would seek and be granted exemptions, permitting them to go back to work. "I did that because I thought it was absolutely essential to make it clear that the Ba'athist ideology, which had been responsible for so many of the human rights abuses and mistreatment of the people in the country over the last 40 years, had to be extirpated finally and completely from society. Much as the American government decided to completely extirpate Nazism from Germany at the end of the Second World War," Bremer said later. Ultimately, the U.S. military in Iraq came to have a mixed view of the purge. Major General Swanwick spoke for many when he later said, "I was not very happy from day one with the debathification program." A 101st Airborne Division summary of issues for a meeting at the CPA later that year listed the big five concerns of the division commander, Major General David Petraeus. Arbitrary debathification was at the top of the list. One of Petraeus's brigade commanders, Colonel Joe Anderson, later summarized the effect of Bremer's order. All of a sudden you say, these guys are not part of society. These were guys and gals in the doctor arena, in the professor arena, that you can't do without in running a society. But not everyone agreed. Brigadier General Martin Dempsey, who commanded the 1st Armored Division in Baghdad, and so had more top Ba'athists in his area of operations, said that in retrospect, Bremer's radical debathification was the right move to make for changing Iraq, albeit a somewhat difficult one. If it hadn't been done, he said, it would have gone easier for us in the near term, but less well for the Iraqi population in the long term. Next came the dissolution of the Iraqi Army and National Police Force. We didn't disband the Army, Walter Slocum would later contend. The Army disbanded itself. That's not the way many others remember what happened. We were working with the Army when we were told to disband them, recalled Marine Major General Mattis. This decision was another significant departure from what Garner had discussed with Rumsfeld and others before leaving Washington for Iraq. One of our goals is to take a good portion of the Iraqi regular army and put them to work in reconstruction, Garner had told reporters at the Pentagon in March. The regular army has the skill sets to match the work that needs to be done. On February 19, Garner had debriefed Rice, the National Security Advisor, on his plans for the Iraqi army. Cannot immediately mobilize, 300 to 400K unemployed, his briefing slide stated. Take advantage of ready labor force. Reconstruction is labor intensive. According to notes he prepared for that meeting, he told her of his preparations for Iraq Regular Army, plan for rapid reorganization. His plan was to use $1.2 billion in frozen assets to pay the military, police, and key civil servants for a few months. Garner had been so determined to stand up the Iraqi military quickly that he had demanded that the job of retraining not be given to the U.S. Army, which he had felt would move too slowly, but to contractors. In response, MPRI, a military consulting firm, had drawn up a detailed plan to use up to 100,000 Iraqi troops as the low-tech end of reconstruction projects. Start with short, simple tasks, clear garbage, remove debris, improve drainage, then longer and more complex tasks, the company's plan stated. But on May 23, Bremer issued CPA Order No. 2, Dissolution of Iraqi Entities, formally doing away with several groups, the Iraqi Armed Forces, which accounted for 385,000 people, the staff of the Ministry of the Interior, which amounted to a surprisingly high 285,000 people, because it included police and domestic security forces, and the presidential security units, a force of some 50,000. Abruptly terminating the livelihoods of these men created a vast pool of humiliated, antagonized, and politicized men, noted Faleh Jabbar, an expert on the Ba'athist Party who was a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Many of these men were armed. In addition, Bremer's order clarified his debathification standard, saying that any person holding the rank under the former regime of colonel or above, or its equivalent, will be deemed a senior party member, and so would not be eligible for any pension payments. This cut off tens of thousands of influential Iraqis, some of them wrongly, because it mistakenly assumed that one couldn't be a senior officer without being a party member. Only later did the CPA learn that even some top Iraqi generals were not in the party, a former CPA official recalled. Central Command was taken aback by the announcement. We were surprised at the dissolution of the Army, said Major General Renouard, adding mildly, so that gave us a challenge. It is a verbal tic of the U.S. military that officers tend to say challenge when they mean problem. Agoglia, working as the military liaison to Bremer, told his boss, you guys just blindsided CENTCOM. That was the day, he recalled, that we snatched defeat from the jaws of victory and created an insurgency. Rumsfeld was surprised by Bremer's move, said a general who spoke frequently with the defense secretary at this time. The joint staff was informed simply by a written note, said Colonel Hughes. There was also some concern inside Feith's office. Abram Shulsky, an intelligence expert and former classmate of Wolfowitz at Cornell University and the University of Chicago, weighed in, writing a note to the Pentagon's general counsel raising concerns about the plan. "I'm not certain I like this," he wrote. "It seems to me we could accomplish the same effect if we said that the regular army weren't dissolved, but would be thoroughly vetted and reformed." Together, Bremer's two orders threw out of work more than 500,000 people and alienated many more dependent on those lost incomes. Just as important, in a country riven by sectarian and ethnic fault lines, Sunni versus Shiite versus Kurd, and possessing few unifying national institutions, Bremer had done away with two of the most important ones. Moreover, the moves undercut the fragile remnants of the police structure. The CPA decision to cleanse the political system of Hussein sympathizers, notably the de-Ba'athification effort, effectively decapitated the IPS, or Iraqi Police Services, a joint study by the inspectors general of the Pentagon and State Department would find 2 years later. At the end of May and in early June, dismissed ministry workers and former Iraqi army soldiers held a series of demonstrations. Some vowed they would violently oppose the U.S. decisions. "All of us will become suicide bombers," former officer Kairi Jassim told Reuters. The wire service article was distributed at the CPA, with that quotation highlighted. "The only thing left for me is to blow myself up in the face of tyrants," another officer told Al Jazeera. Bremer insisted he wouldn't be moved. "We are not going to be blackmailed into producing programs because of threats of terrorism," he said at a press conference in early June. The protests continued. On June 18, an estimated 2,000 Iraqi soldiers gathered outside the Green Zone to denounce the dissolution decision. Some carried signs that said, "Please keep your promises." Others threw rocks. "We will take up arms," Tahsin Ali Hussein vowed in a speech to the demonstrators, according to an account by Agence France-Presse. "We are all very well-trained soldiers and we are armed. We will start ambushes, bombings, and even suicide bombings. We will not let the Americans rule us in such a humiliating way." U.S. soldiers fired into the crowd, killing two. In the weeks after that, U.S. commanders grew increasingly concerned by the unrest the order caused. At about this time, General Sanchez was formally promoted from commander of the 1st Armored Division to commander of 5 Corps, the headquarters for all U.S. military operations in Iraq. At the reception after the change of command ceremony, Major General Petraeus confronted Walt Slocum. "The failure to pay ex-officers was getting U.S. troops hurt," he warned Slocum, "and the longer the demobilized Iraqi soldiers were left hanging, the more dangerous they would become." "They are really tinder out there just waiting for a spark," Petraeus told him, who then promised to press the issue. A few days later, Rumsfeld approved the payment, and the officers' protests ended. Perhaps just as significant as those two controversial moves of Bremer's was his third major decision. There wouldn't be an Iraqi government any time soon, despite Garner's plan to set one up. "It simply was not possible," he later said. Bremer also soon began pursuing a program aimed at moving Iraq toward a free market economy, beginning by shutting down unprofitable state-run industries. This had the political effect of further alienating the middle class, which already had been hit by de-Ba'athification and which was full of managers from those inefficient industries. The combination of all these moves, a prolonged foreign occupation that was built on de-Ba'athification, dissolution of the military, and economic upheaval, radically undercut social stability and built opposition to the American presence. "What we have done over the last 6 months in Al-Anbar has been a recipe for instability," Keith Mines would write in a November memo. "Through aggressive de-Ba'athification, the demobilization of the army, and the closing of factories, the coalition has left tens of thousands of individuals outside the economic and political life of the country." It didn't take long for Iraqi resentment to become palpable. Major Christopher Varhola, a reservist trained as an anthropologist, recalled being at a meeting in the Green Zone in late May 2003 between Ambassador Hume Horan, a senior CPA official, and a group of about 270 tribal leaders. The general mood was one of impatience with the American effort and a suspicion that it was intentionally slow. Varhola recalled, Sheikh Munter Aboud of Amara began by thanking Horan for the removal of Saddam Hussein. But, he continued, he needed to know if the United States believed itself to be an occupier or a liberator. Horan, an honest man, replied that he believed the U.S. was somewhere in between those two approaches. If America was a liberator, then we were welcome indefinitely as guests, the Sheikh responded, according to notes of the meeting. He stated, however, that if we were occupiers, then he and his descendants would die resisting us. This met with energetic applause from the audience. Then, about one quarter of those present, about 65 of the Iraqis at the meeting, stood and walked out. Late in the spring of 2003, an army officer filling an intelligence position in Baghdad began using some of the Iraqi exiles assigned to him to conduct a quiet survey of what was being said in mosques on Fridays. He was worried that there was little unbiased, systematic reporting of Iraqi public sentiment, which he thought needed tracking. In addition, he thought it was important to get a handle on the structure of the clergy and of the alliances between them. Wanting to share his results, he went over one day and mentioned his reporting system to the communications people at CPA. They weren't interested, and told him, "That's tactical. Take it to the army." So he sought out an army colonel, who read the reports eagerly and focused on anti-American comments made in one sermon. The colonel told the officer that the offending cleric must be arrested. The officer protested. All the religious leaders were anti-American, at least in their rhetoric. You can't survive as a cleric if you don't denounce the Americans, the officer explained. The key, he thought, was to distinguish between those clerics who settled for using only words and those who advocated violence. Worried that additional reporting could provoke more arrest orders, as well as endanger the Iraqis gathering the information, the intelligence officer shut down his collection network. For weeks in the late spring and early summer, Rumsfeld and other officials declined to say that they were facing a continuing war in Iraq. His exchanges with reporters during this period underscored what one defense expert termed the institutional resistance to thinking seriously about the situation. Rumsfeld's refusal to say he was facing war sent a signal downward across the military establishment, that most hierarchical of institutions, built to act on the words and views of those at the top. More than at any other time in the painful history of the U.S. intervention in Iraq, even more than during the formulation of the war plan, that late spring was the point at which Rumsfeld might have made a decisive difference. Some in the military saw Rumsfeld as a strong leader, while others disparaged him as a bully. In either case, it was at this point that his strong personality could have been useful in forcing the U.S. military to understand that it was caught in a counterinsurgency campaign and would need to make wrenching adjustments to win, just as other conventional militaries had in similar situations. Instead, Rumsfeld's self-confident stubbornness made him a big part of the problem. The defense secretary's vulnerability wasn't that he made errors. It was that he seemed unable to recognize them and make adjustments. As Baghdad was looted, the defense secretary seemed to freeze. Rumsfeld was having difficulty recognizing the reality of what was happening in Iraq, and instead was arguing powerfully for his mistaken point of view. Donald Rumsfeld is a remarkably complex study, with huge reservoirs of talent and intelligence, marred by towering hubris, retired Army Colonel Lloyd Matthews, a former editor of Parameters, the Army's premier journal, commented that summer. "He's up, he's down, and he'll continue in this sine wave pattern throughout his public career, and very likely be down at the end, because he fails to realize that despite his gifts, he is in a business where defeats are inevitable, where all victories are fleeting, and where one's best defense is the homely quality of grace and humility which he so sorely lacks." On June 19, Rumsfeld appeared at the Pentagon briefing room, Garner standing by his side. He wouldn't call the situation in Iraq a war. There's no question but that in those regions where pockets of dead-enders are trying to reconstitute, General Franks and his team are rooting them out. He also engaged in a verbal sleight of hand about the 42 U.S. soldiers who had died in Iraq in the previous 6 weeks since Bush's declaration that the war was over. Look, you got to remember that if Washington, D.C. were the size of Baghdad, we would be having something like 215 murders a month, he said. There's going to be violence in a big city. It's 5.5 million people. In fact, there probably were many more murders than that in the chaos of Baghdad. It wasn't unusual at the time to see cars swerving around a dead body lying in morning traffic. What Rumsfeld was looking at were the statistics on the deaths of U.S. troops, that is, the people trying to bring security to the area. So the equivalent would not be the murder rate in the general population, but among law enforcement personnel. If 215 police officers were being killed monthly in Washington, D.C., it would be regarded as a major crisis, as indeed was the case in Baghdad at the time, despite Rumsfeld's anodyne insistence that the coalition is making good progress. On the same day, Wolfowitz, testifying on Capitol Hill, portrayed the nascent insurgency as remnants of the old regime. He told the House Armed Services Committee, "I think these people are the last remnants of a dying cause." To be fair, Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz were reflecting what they were hearing from some subordinate commanders. On June 18, Major General Raymond Odierno, commander of the 4th Infantry Division, which had taken over to Crete, emphatically rejected the idea that he was facing an insurrectionary movement. "This is not guerrilla warfare," he told reporters. "It is not close to guerrilla warfare, because it's not coordinated, it's not organized, and it's not led. The soldiers that are conducting these operations don't even have the willpower. We find that a majority of the time they'll fire a shot, and they'll drop the weapon and they'll give up right away. They do not have the will. And in most cases, I'm not sure they really believe in what they're doing." Odierno launched a series of operations, Peninsula Strike, Desert Scorpion, Sidewinder, and Ivy Serpent, that were portrayed as efforts to mop up bits and pieces of the Iraqi military and the Ba'athist Party leadership. "Looking back on that time over a year later," he said, "I didn't believe it was an insurgency until about July. What we really thought was remnant. After the first and second operations, I thought that would be the end of it." But while Odierno's mistaken assessment may explain why Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz spoke as they did, it doesn't excuse them. One of the most important responsibilities of senior leaders is to assess a given situation and set the strategic response. By month's end, the media was baiting Bush administration officials, asking them at every opportunity whether they were willing to admit they were in a war in Iraq. "Isn't it accurate to call it a guerrilla war?" a reporter asked Rumsfeld as the defense secretary emerged from a closed meeting with senators on Capitol Hill. "I don't know that I would use the word," Rumsfeld said. "Rather," he said, "there was no question that criminals and leftover remnants of the Saddam Hussein regime were being unhelpful." 3 days later, Rumsfeld was pressed on the issue once again by reporters at a Pentagon briefing. "Can you remind us again why this isn't a quagmire?" asked CNN's Jamie McIntyre, a veteran of over a decade on the Pentagon beat. "And can you tell us why you're so reluctant to say that what's going on in Iraq now is a guerrilla war?" "I guess the reason I don't use the phrase guerrilla war is because there isn't one, and it would be a misunderstanding and a miscommunication to you and to the people of the country and the world," Rumsfeld responded. McIntyre persisted, reading aloud to Rumsfeld the official Defense Department definition of guerrilla war: "Military and paramilitary operations conducted in enemy-held or hostile territory by irregular ground indigenous forces." "This seems to fit a lot of what's going on in Iraq," McIntyre noted. Rumsfeld brushed aside his assertion. "It really doesn't," he said. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who always seemed to make his top priority staying in step with Rumsfeld, also insisted that the situation was better than it looked, or than the media was reporting. "There's been a lot of work done," General Myers said in early July. "A lot of the country is relatively stable." Over the next year, Myers would make similar comments, repeatedly insisting that the situation was better than it looked, even as Iraq descended into guerrilla war and many hundreds of U.S. troops died. This pattern of fatuity raises the question of whether Myers provided in private the blunt advice that Rumsfeld and other senior officials needed to hear. Behind closed doors, some were telling Rumsfeld and Myers to think again. General Jack Keane, the Army's number two officer, who had taken over many functions of the top job as Shinseki's team waned, including many contacts with Rumsfeld, insisted in a meeting of the Joint Chiefs that it was essential to understand the nature of the war in Iraq. It was, he said, according to an officer who was there, a low-level insurgency that has the potential to grow. Keane warned that it was time to come to grips with that fact. President Bush's response to the growing violence in Iraq was even more painfully wrong than Rumsfeld's. The defense secretary was mistaken in understanding the situation, but the president's comments may have actually exacerbated it. On July 2, Bush took the unusual step of taunting Iraqis and others violently opposed to the U.S. presence in Iraq. "There are some who feel that the conditions are such that they can attack us there," he said. "My answer is, bring 'em on. We've got the force necessary to deal with the security situation." The president's words were reported and remembered in Iraq and across the Middle East. A year later, the Islamic Jihad Army would issue a communique that pointedly inquired, "Have you another challenge?" In mid-May, the 1st Armored Division moved into Iraq, and at month's end it took over as the leading edge of the occupation in the capital. Its commander was Army Major General Ricardo Sanchez, who soon would be promoted and given command of the U.S. ground effort in Iraq. If there is any tragic figure at the top of the American effort in Iraq, it is Sanchez. He was, by all accounts, a good man, somewhat gruff, but hardworking, dedicated, and doing what he was trained to do. But there are few people who contend that he was the man for the job, or that he succeeded in Iraq. Sanchez was an American success story, a dirt-poor Mexican-American kid from the Rio Grande Valley who became the first in his family to go to college, and then he rose to become a senior commander in the U.S. Army. In the Army, he had studied systems analysis, had led a battalion under General McCaffrey in the 1991 Gulf War, had been director of operations at Southern Command, the U.S. military headquarters for operations in South America, and commanded the peacekeeping force in Kosovo. There was and is much to respect about him, but methodical Sanchez often appeared overwhelmed by the situation, with little grasp of the strategic problems he faced. The opinion of many of his peers was that he was a fine battalion commander, who never should have commanded a division, let alone a corps or a nationwide occupation mission. "He was in over his head," said Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Holshek, who served in Iraq in 2003. "He was a fulfillment of the Peter Principle, which holds that people working in hierarchies such as the U.S. Army are promoted until they reach their level of incompetence, at which point they tend to fail spectacularly." Sanchez's most visible failing was his relentless focus on minutia. He was aware that subordinates criticized him for that. "I am very comfortable with a macro look at things, unless I see we have issues," he said one day in his headquarters at the Baghdad airport. When he saw a troubled area, he said, he was determined to dive into it. "When I see we are not paying attention to detail, I get into that," he said. "It is the deep, penetrating questions that embarrass people. I can be pretty rough and penetrating, and sometimes that can get embarrassing if you don't know what you're talking about." But what Sanchez saw as incisive leadership, some around him saw as trivially minded distraction. "All trees, no forest," said one State Department official. "A great logistician, but what's he doing commanding American forces in that part of the world? Not a strategic or political thought." On top of that, Sanchez was placed in the middle of an extraordinarily difficult and tangled command situation. In other U.S. occupations, the commander had been a four-star general, such as Douglas MacArthur in post-war Japan, and Lucius Clay at the same time in Germany. Sanchez was a three-star, that is, a lieutenant general, and in fact the most junior one in the U.S. Army. He jumped from commanding a division of fewer than 20,000 troops to leading a combined U.S. and Allied force of about 180,000 men and women, and in doing so, he was woefully undersupported. The Pentagon calculated that he needed a headquarters staff of 1,400, but during 2003, he was given a fraction of that, at one point hitting a low of just 495. That understaffing was symptomatic of a far larger problem. Sanchez was working for a chain of command that was laboring under a series of false assumptions about post-war Iraq, and that didn't understand the situation it was facing, and so it was consistently underestimating the difficulties it faced and the resources it would need to devote to the problem. On top of that, he was burdened by a jerry-rigged command structure in which there was no one American official, civilian or military, on the ground in Iraq in charge of the overall American effort. Rather, both Sanchez and Bremer reported up to Secretary Rumsfeld, who was at the Pentagon, some 7,000 miles away. Unity of command is a universal principle in military operations, noted Army Reserve Major Michael Eisenstadt, who served as an intelligence officer in the staff of Central Command. It is especially important in putting down an insurgency, he said, because you need to integrate your political, economic, and military activities. Sanchez struggled in the following months. Subordinates report that he tried to focus on achieving victory through quantifying progress, rather than by looking at hazier but perhaps better indicators, such as the quality of the Iraqi police or the polls about what concerned the average Iraqi. I don't think he ever understood the people aspect, that he had to win the will of the Iraqi people, said one subordinate who speaks Arabic and so paid more attention to Iraqi life than most officers. In personal interactions, he also could be difficult. He tended to strike other officers as remote. Lieutenant General Thomas Metz, his fellow lieutenant general in Iraq, later described him in a legal statement that grew out of the Abu Ghraib situation as pretty introverted.